Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, Larry Mueller here. Today we're going to start the show by talking with you about birds' eggs. They're fascinating, and I think we rarely take the time to appreciate them. We're going to do that today as we visit with Tim Burkhead from the UK. He teaches animal behavior and the history of science at the University of Sheffield. He's the fellow of the Royal Society of London, an award-winning author. He's a great writer. His latest book is called The Most Perfect Thing Inside and Outside a Bird's Egg. And in it, he explores every aspect of this perfect little container, from how a shell is formed to how it's colored, what end of the egg comes out first. Well, what intrigues you about eggs? Join the conversation. Maybe you've got an experience to share or a question. Call in at 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Just look for The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page. And if you've got some cool photos of eggs, we would love to see them as well. And Tim Burkhead, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, hello.
Well, it's wonderful to have be able to talk with you about your book. And you tell some amazing stories here. Tell us first about Skomer Island and the birds that live there.
Okay, well, Skomer Island lies off the west coast of South Wales. It's, you know, when you look at a map of Great Britain, it's what I call the pig's nose. You know, Wales, the top bit is the ear, and the bottom peninsula, I think of as the pig's nose, and it's off the tip of there. It's one of the most westerly points in Wales. And I've been working there for over 40 years now on guillemots.
And
it is actually one of my most favorite places in the world. It's remarkable. And the guillemot population in the 1930s was about 100,000 pairs, so a massive colony. And then shortly after World War II, it plummeted to just a few thousand. And since 1980, numbers have been going steadily up again, which is great news. But it's going to take another 50 years, if nothing else intervenes, to get us back to 100,000 pairs.
Well, you tell a story right off the bat. An amazing story about a guy hanging 150 feet over a cliff on a rope to collect guillemot eggs.
Yeah, I mean, because guillemots breed in colonies, and as I've indicated, sometimes very big colonies, and because they also breed at very high density, you can have 70 or 80 eggs per square meter on a big, broad ledge. They've always been very attractive to people who want to eat eggs. And, of course, a guillemot's egg is about three times the size of a hen's egg. And, you know, in less than 50 or 60 years ago, there were no battery chickens, so, you know, it wasn't easy to get large numbers of eggs. If you visited a guillemot colony, or you would call it a murre colony, then you could obviously collect a huge number of eggs. And people went to extraordinary lengths to do that.
And they are beautiful eggs. Oh, my gosh. The four-color photos you have in the middle, I think, for me, sort of epitomizes, well, lets us know why people have searched for eggs and why they're so fascinated by them. They're beautiful, different colors, shapes, and sizes.
Yes, I mean, the variety of colors and types of markings that there are on birds' eggs is just incredible. And those colors and markings have evolved for lots of different reasons. And as you say, just the sheer beauty of eggs is one of the reasons why in the past people collected eggs. Of course, that's completely illegal now, but you can sort of see why people like to have them.
And the guillemot egg, the colors are fascinating, and I think you point out in your book that no egg is the same. They're all different.
Yeah, no two eggs are the same. That's what people say. That's what the collectors say. And the guillemot's egg, because it's so variable and because it's so beautiful as well, was one of the real favorites amongst collectors. If you were an amateur collector, your collection wasn't complete unless you had a good sample of guillemot eggs. And, of course, the reason there is all that variation is that it allows a female and her partner to recognize their own eggs. So a guillemot would lay on a bare rocky ledge. It makes no nest. And because the guillemots are all packed together, there's a bit of a risk that if your egg rolls away, it could get muddled up with somebody else's. And so that variation in colour and markings, that's evolved specifically to allow them to recognise their own egg. And people have done little experiments where you move a guillemot's egg a few centimetres to one side and then put another one of a different type close by, and then the guillemot comes back and has to make a decision. And when you do that, they always go for their own egg. So it's very clear that they recognise that. And not many birds have that ability, mainly because most of them don't have to, because they lay their eggs in a nest.
And the shape of those eggs is interesting too. It's a very large egg. You'd think they'd roll off the ledge.
Well, if the birds are disturbed, as they sometimes are by something like a fox or an Arctic fox or a polar bear, then many of those eggs do roll off the ledge. And for a long time, it's been thought that the very pointed shape of guillemot eggs was an adaptation to minimize the risk of rolling. There are two stories there, and neither of them are wholly accurate. The first story, which was actually debunked about 150 years ago, was that the egg would spin like a horizontal top if it was knocked. And that's nonsense, because that's only true if it's an empty egg that's from a museum drawer where it doesn't have a yolk or albumen inside. The slightly more accurate, but not wholly accurate, other explanation is that that cone shape, that pointed shape, allows the egg to roll in an arc. The problem with that idea is that the arc in which a guillemot egg will roll, if it's knocked, is quite big, and usually much bigger and much wider than the ledge on which the guillemot breeds. And in fact, there's very little experimental evidence that suggests that that shape is any better than, say, a hen's egg-shaped egg. So I think, although that's an appealing idea that the shape has evolved to stop it rolling off the ledge, the evidence for that is almost non-existent.
Well, I can hear your excitement in your voice as you talk about eggs, but you've written many books about birds. Why make this one just about eggs?
That's a good question. Okay, so I've studied birds all my life, and I just feel myself to be incredibly fortunate to basically turn my hobby into my job. I also love teaching undergraduate students, and writing books for me is a kind of an extension of teaching. But why this particular book? Well, most of my research has been on how sperm fertilize eggs. So I spent 40 years studying sperm, mainly bird sperm. And then a few years ago, I thought, gosh, maybe it would be appropriate to kind of redress the balance and start thinking a little bit about eggs. And then somebody was on television, wildlife presenter, and he told this story about eggs spinning like a top. And I was so aghast.
I remember you put that in your book.
Yes, so aghast that the idea that would been debunked so long ago was now presented to millions of viewers yet again as though it was fact. And so that was one of the triggers that made me want to write this book to try and set the record straight. And so, of course, as soon as I started reading about this and doing research on eggs, I just realized this was just a wide open field, very exciting.
Yeah.
So there's one other element as well.
Yeah.
As I've said, collecting eggs is illegal. And because of that, many famous naturalists like David Attenborough in Britain, I mean, when he was a boy, he collected eggs, and he would be the first to admit that that action of going out and finding nests and collecting eggs was his engagement with nature. And there's great concern that today young people have very little engagement with nature. And because we've been more or less brainwashed into thinking touching birds' nests and eggs is completely wrong, and of course it is, there is a kind of detachment between the way young people view the world and how they view nature. So what I wanted to do here was to try and redress the balance a little bit in this respect, and to say just because collecting eggs is illegal doesn't mean to say you have to ignore all that wonderful history about the biology of eggs.
You know, in your book, you talk about the fact that most of the research on eggs was done by, you know, commercial concerns, and not so much on wild birds. How has the study of eggs helped science?
That's a very good question. In terms of some of the stuff that we've done, I think it's shed new light on the processes of fertilization itself. Now, as most people know, it takes one sperm and one egg to form a human embryo. And often when that's discussed on the TV news. They show an image of what's called intracytoplasmic sperm injection, where an egg is being held by a little pipette and a single sperm is injected into it. And that's how people who are looking for assisted reproduction go about having a baby. So the idea of one egg and one sperm is deeply embedded in our minds. But about 120, 130 years ago, a researcher looking at birds' eggs was constantly puzzled by the fact that there could be as many as 60 sperm right inside the egg near what we call the female pronucleus. That's the bit of the egg that contains the female DNA. And I was always puzzled by the fact that nobody raised an eyebrow at this. Nobody said, well, that's pretty weird. That's very different from what happens in humans. And so for years I'd been thinking about this idea. And then we were doing some experiments where we were trying to do artificial insemination, which of course is routine in chickens, but more difficult in other birds. And we were trying to do this on little zebra finches. And my colleague said, it's very weird. Whenever we try to introduce sperm into the female, only ever do we get one sperm into the egg. And I thought, that's gives us an opportunity to start to look at how critical it is to have these extra sperm. So we did some experiments, and very interestingly, every egg that had a single sperm was indeed fertilized. That's fantastic. But in every single case, the embryo died. When we allowed many more sperm to enter the egg, the eggs were fertilized and the embryos all survived. Very convincing experimental evidence that these extra sperm have a crucial role, not in fertilization per se, but in kick-starting embryo development. And so it turns out that a number of other organisms have this phenomenon. It's called polyspermia. It simply means many sperm, and it implies many sperm are needed for development. Some amphibians and a few other organisms have this as well. So what we see in mammals and humans like ourselves is a rather atypical form of reproduction with one sperm and one egg. And what we think is happening is that those additional sperm release something, probably calcium, that kick-starts the embryo's development. So there are some kind of fundamental issues relating to both animal and human reproduction that we can learn from looking at eggs.
Tim Burkhead, our guest today, he is the author of The Most Perfect Thing Inside and Outside a Bird's Egg. We'll take your calls at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or post a question on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 11:45, we'll be talking with the author of the new book. It's called Torn in Two, The Sinking of the Daniel Morrell and One Man's Survival on the Open Sea. So I hope you'll stay with us for that. Right now, we're taking a look at the egg. The Tim Burkhead is the author of The Most Perfect Thing Inside and Outside a Bird's Egg, and it's kind of exploring the egg with him today, and I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Tim, let's talk about how an egg, you know, to me, it's just an amazing thing. And you do such a nice job of describing how an egg is formed inside the bird with the shell and everything.
Well, it starts off with the yolk forming. And strictly speaking, the yolk is what we would call an ovum, and that's equivalent to a human egg. It's not, in bird sense, it's not an egg until it's got the shell on it. And so a little bird, like a finch or a sparrow, might take 5 days for the yolk to grow from a kind of millimeter-sized speck to something that's, you know, 5 or 6 millimeters across. In a bigger bird like an albatross, it can take 6 or 8 weeks to form the yolk. Once the yolk is formed and it's reached its full size, then the little bag that holds it splits and the ovum is dropped into the female reproductive tract, the oviduct, and it's caught by a kind of funnel-like structure which is called the infundibulum. And lying in folds in the infundibulum are the sperm that the females received from the male during previous matings. And within that first 15 minutes, the ovum is fertilized. And as I said, in birds, that will involve up to 60 different sperm penetrating the egg. The egg then, the ovum, sorry, then starts its journey down the oviduct. And the first thing that happens is that the albumen is slapped on around the ovum, around the yolk. And it's very dense. It's not like the albumen or the white that you would get in an egg that you crack open from the supermarket, because it hasn't got very much water in it so far. It comes down, and about 4 or 5 hours later, it enters a region that in birds is called the uterus, not quite equivalent to that in humans. And this is where the shell membrane starts to be laid down around the coating of albumin. And the shell membrane is that thin, papery layer that you get when you open a hard-boiled egg, and it's kind of just inside the shell. And that forms the foundation on which the shell proper will be laid down. So as soon as the membrane's finished, and of course that's when the shape of the egg is actually determined, not by the shell itself, by the membrane. When that membrane is finished, the calcium starts to be deposited on top of it in a very specific way. And that's a long, drawn-out process. It takes about 18 to 20 hours. At the end of that shell deposition, the shell is hard, and the shell is hard and lying inside the uterus. The next thing that happens is the color is sprayed on, and the way I think of it is inside the uterus there are hundreds or maybe thousands or maybe millions of tiny spray guns, each with a little squirt of color. And that covers the egg, and then the final process is the equivalent of a kind of layer of wax on a car leaving a factory. It's called the cuticle, and that just finishes everything off. The egg then just sits inside the uterus maybe for an hour or two before it is finally laid. And as soon as it's laid, the next ovum is released from the ovary. So it works on a 24-hour cycle, which is, of course, why chickens' eggs, you know, you go and collect one every 24 hours.
It's an amazing process. And that whole process about color, there were all kinds of theory about how an egg gets its color. And we think about here in Wisconsin, I think the most... The robin is our state bird, and robin's mm-hmm. egg blue, that color is just wonderful. And I think probably most people listening have probably observed one at one time or another, but how a robin, for example, makes that blue color every time, and they're pretty much the same color every single time, is just an amazing process.
Well, basically, there are just two color pigments in the bird's system. One is a bluey-green color, as you've indicated, for the robin, and another is a kind of reddish color. And it's literally out of just those two pigments that the entire array of all the colors and colors of markings that we see in birds' eggs can be produced. That just seems so kind of ingenious. So by careful mixing of those two, as I say, you can get almost any color, eggs that range from almost brick red to, like the robin, sky blue. And then often birds have eggs have dark markings, and that can be either of the two pigments in very high concentrations so that they appear almost black. Now, the two pigments are both what we call the breakdown products from bile or blood, and then they're moved into the circulatory system, deposited in these tiny glands, which I call the spray guns, and then released at a very critical time. And this is a very difficult area for scientists to explore, because if you find a dead bird that's in the process of egg laying and you dissect it and open it up, you generally can't find any color in those glands at all. So it's always been a bit of a mystery. People then got confused and they thought that maybe it was literally blood, the pressure of the egg coming down the oviduct burst blood vessels, and the egg was then colored by the blood. That's nonsense. That isn't what happens. But what does seem to happen, and we don't have much information about this, is that in just minutes before the spray gun fires, the cells that are going to make the pigment make it very quickly. It's then released onto the egg, and then those glands are empty. So if you've kind of missed it, there's nothing to see.
And the speckled ones always get to me. How they come up with, can inject these little spots around some of the eggs that you see?
We don't really know. So most birds, the markings, it's called the maculation, is more concentrated at the blunt end. So depending on which way the egg is orientated in the uterus, there presumably are more of these little spray guns in that region. The thing that really puzzles me, though, are those eggs that have long drawn-out squiggles or pencil-like markings. I can only imagine that once the spray gun is fired, the egg then rotates very rapidly in all sorts of different directions. But if you look at the markings on those eggs, they're so clean, it's almost impossible to imagine how they're created in that way.
It's just amazing. And as you point out in your book, I mean, you can... For some birds, you can walk along, for example, a beach where some eggs are laid, and you can't see the egg almost because it matches so carefully with the color of the sand or whatever.
Of course, that's one of the main reasons why birds' eggs are colored. For those birds that breed, nest on the ground, being camouflaged is very important. So years of natural selection have kind of honed those colors until they match the kind of pebbles to a great degree of perfection. At the other extreme, birds that nest in burrows or in holes in trees, like owls and kingfishers and so on, their eggs are invariably white, presumably because there's no need for them to be camouflaged, and probably because that white color enables the parent bird just to see, using whatever light there is, the egg inside the nest so it doesn't tread on it.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Let's let our listeners join in. You can call in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Let's go to Glenn in Fox Lake next. Glenn, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. A number of years ago, a friend of mine shot a bearded turkey hen by mistake, which was legal. And when he dressed it, he found like 9 eggs. The first one was larger, and then it got smaller, and the last one was like the size of a pea. So he thought that was pretty interesting. And then the other question is, do those eggs have to be fertilized each time, or when they're bred, are all the eggs fertile?
Okay, that's a really interesting question. So what your friend saw was what I would call the hierarchy of ova at different stages of development. And the biggest one, obviously, would be the first one to be ovulated. And then when that was in the process of coming down the oviduct to be made into an egg, the next one would be growing to the same size, ready to be ovulated and fertilized 24 hours later. And that's true in all birds that you see. There is this hierarchy of ova as they develop. Now, it used to be thought that one mating would fertilize all the eggs and fertilize them before they were released from the ovary. But that's not true. The egg has to be released from the ovary and caught at the top of the oviduct, and each egg is fertilized individually. The reason why people were confused is that birds have this remarkable ability to store sperm, sometimes for 2 months. Humans can't do anything like that. You know, the maximum interval in humans between mating and fertilization is about 5 days, but in some birds it's 2 months. And what happens is that the sperm in these little storage tubules at the other end of the reproductive tract release the sperm in a constant stream, so that for each egg, as it's ovulated at 24-hour intervals, has a supply of sperm to fertilize it.
Oh, very interesting.
Okay, so it takes about, no matter how many eggs there are, it takes a day for each one to be laid.
Absolutely, yep. There's a few species where it takes 48 hours rather than 24 hours, but in most species it's 24 hours.
Okay, very, very good. Thank you, very interesting.
Yeah, thanks a
Pleasure.
Lot. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Glenn. Jeff in Kokana emailed to say that if you look at the color of a chicken egg, the shell, the color goes all the way through, not just on the outside, at least in his opinion, or from his sighting. Is that true in other eggs?
That's also a great question. In some species, that is true, that there is color deposited at the same time that the shell is being formed. In the guillemots that we were talking about earlier, that seems to be the case. In other species, the color is very superficial, and in one or two species, like the ptarmigan, which breeds in the far north, some of the color, when the egg is laid, you can just wipe it off, and then you're left with a white egg, which is pretty remarkable. So I think there's a whole range of different ways of depositing that color.
Oh, very interesting. You can join in, too. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. I'd love to hear from you. There's so much interesting research that you talk about in a very compelling way about the birds. And one that kind of struck me was this whole process of incubating eggs. And the female goldcrest, I think you talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's a very small bird, but it has many, many eggs, almost seemingly more than it could cover and incubate.
Absolutely. So most birds incubate their clutch of eggs by having them in contact with what's called the brood patch. And this is an area of bare skin on the lower abdomen that is charged with blood vessels. And the parent bird that's incubating, can be male or female, has fantastic control over the blood flow through that brood patch. So if you were to artificially cool down, say, a nest box, the bird could increase the blood flow to keep the eggs at the right temperature. Similarly, for some birds breeding in the tropics, if it's a very hot day, they can increase the blood flow to take the heat away from the eggs. But the goldcrest is absolutely fascinating. And it's Britain's tiniest bird. And it was just weighs about the same as a teaspoonful of sugar. It's really tiny. But it lays, for its body size, the biggest eggs of almost any bird, quite big. And its brood patch can only cover about 3 of the 10 eggs that it normally lays. And it's got round this problem in a very unusual way. What it does is to pump blood through its legs, so they act like the heater in an immersion heater. Not only that, the bird paddles its legs whilst it's incubating, stirring them up so that heat is dissipated throughout the entire clutch. And that was discovered by an Austrian colleague of mine, Ellen Thaler, and she attached a microphone to the inside of a goldcrest nest, and she could hear the eggs constantly rolling and tumbling. And she discovered the blood flow into the bird's legs by noticing that when the female came off the nest, her legs were bright red. But when she came back after a few minutes, her legs had gone back to a kind of normal brown color. And the blood flow through the legs increases the heat in order to incubate that big clutch very efficiently.
That's an amazing story. I love that story. Mary in Germantown has a question for you. Hi, Mary. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm wondering about white eggs. Do they have a color sprayed on at all? Or in those birds, is there no spraying of color?
That's a great question. And in the 1970s, when people were first starting to analyze the chemicals that comprise those two pigments, they looked at white eggs. And to their surprise, they do contain either one or other of the two colors, two pigments, or sometimes both, but presumably at a low enough concentration that they wouldn't produce a color on the eggshell itself. And then there's a few other species where you can't detect either of those two colors. So that's a great point.
Yeah, thank you for calling. And there are some chickens that lay brown eggs.
There are, and if you're a Brit or a British housewife, brown eggs is what you want to buy from the supermarket in North America. People prefer white eggs, and the poultry industry has created strains of chickens that produce only white eggs in North America and only brown eggs over here. And that's just a kind of quirk of people's preferences. In Britain, people think that brown eggs are healthier, but I don't think they are.
Okay. Well, here a young caller, 8 years old, Maverick from Pembine, has something. Hi, thank you for calling.
Welcome.
Yeah, what question do you have?
What bird lays the most eggs in its entire life?
Oh, that's an interesting question as well. So the birds that lay big clutches of eggs, so we just talked about the goldcrest that might lay 10 eggs, those tend to be rather short-lived birds. So a goldcrest might only live 2 or 3 years. So let's say it lives 3 years, it might produce 30 eggs during its lifetime. So something like an albatross, which is incredibly long-lived, only lays one egg, and in some species only lays one egg every second year. But let's take a species that lays one egg a year. They can live for 40 years. So an albatross, even though it lays just one egg a year, in its entire lifetime might produce 40 eggs.
Every second year.
Yeah, very interesting. Thank you for calling, Maverick. Appreciate your call. Gordon in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Gordon.
Yes, see, you know, he's very, the guest is very well versed on eggs. I mean, we can understand that. I'm just wondering if he has a opinion on what came first, the chicken or the egg.
Okay, that's a favorite question, and I think it's absolutely clear that the egg came first, because the ancestors of birds were dinosaurs, reptiles, and they were all producing eggs. So I think there's absolutely no question that the egg came first.
Okay, there we go. Thanks, Gordon. Let's turn to Bill next in, I think, Waupaca. Hi, Bill. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I've always had a question about, like, with a wild bird, like a turkey, how they can lay an egg and, you know, over a period of 10 days, however big the clutch is going to be, and that those original laid eggs, you know, they're off the nest a lot, and how those eggs can survive on their own, and then when they start to set on them, then they all hatch at the same time. Kind of wonder about that.
Okay, that's a great question. So precisely because of what you've just said, birds lay one egg a day, and some birds don't start to incubation until the clutch is complete. So once the egg is fertilized and has come down the oviduct and been laid, there is some development. So by the time the egg is laid, there might be 60 or 70,000 embryonic cells in that egg. So there is an embryo there, but it's in a state of suspended animation and can be brought to life, obviously, when it starts to receive the heat, the warmth from the incubating parent. And that is a pretty remarkable ability. Now, the general belief is that once incubation starts, if an egg gets chilled, that will kill the embryo and disrupt that process. But there are a number of species, particularly those that feed far out at sea, where the embryo, whatever stage it is at, has remarkable tolerance of being left to chill. Once, when I was studying guillemots on Scone Island, I saw a bird lose its egg, and it rolled into a little crevice, and the bird came back and it couldn't get it out of this crevice. It kept coming back, and this egg sat there for something like 5 days, halfway through incubation, and I just assumed that it was doomed. And then for some reason the egg was dislodged and the parent bird sat on it again, and I watched and thought, well, that'll never hatch. But it did. And so some of these embryos are just remarkably tough, and of course that's an adaptation to living in an environment where food supply is unpredictable, and sometimes eggs might be left for longer than you would normally think appropriate.
Very interesting. Thanks,
that's
Bill.
Amazing. Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you.
Jim in Oshkosh, your turn now. Hi, Jim. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I have got 7 chickens, and they lay eggs just constantly. And I know they're fed correctly and so forth, but this morning one of the eggs had no shell, and I was just curious what caused that, and how often does that happen with chickens?
Okay, that's a great question. Under normal circumstances amongst wild birds, it's actually quite rare. But in the Netherlands, in the 1970s and 80s, when acid rain was a problem, acid rain killed all the snails, and little birds like chickadees and titmice and so on rely on snail shells to give them the calcium in order to make the eggshells. And after this period of acid rain, many of those birds laid eggs without shells. And, of course, they all died because the water evaporates through the shell membrane very rapidly. So it's fatal. When you keep chickens, sometimes if they don't get enough grit or a crushed eggshell, you can have that kind of problem. And sometimes even when you do give them everything that they require, there's some little error that takes place in the bird's oviduct and the shell doesn't appear properly. It's not unusual, but it's not very common either.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim, for calling. Appreciate it. And More callers. Let's see. Tom in Green Bay. Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question. It is my understanding that in the past few years, historically, it was that you couldn't get DNA out of an old eggshell. And it is my understanding that this now has been done simply because of a slip-up in the procedure that somebody made, and that old egg collections, you can now obtain DNA from them. And some of the information is quite interesting.
Okay, that's absolutely true. It's a kind of a fantastic development in molecular biology that has allowed us to be able to extract DNA from bits of shell. Normally what people use is the membrane. So if you were to visit a museum and look at some old eggs, inside the hole that has been used to extract the yolk and albumin, you can sometimes see a little bit of this papery membrane. And that's the best source of DNA. But you can also get DNA out of a bit of shell itself without the membrane, because there's a little bit of protein mixed in with the calcium to help form the eggshell. It's quite tricky to be able to do that, but you're absolutely right that that new technology is going to revolutionize the way we think about museum collections. As I said earlier, people are rather averse to collecting eggs, and often they don't even like the idea of there being egg collections in museums. But this new technique will mean that we can interrogate egg collections with a very high degree of sophistication. And I have colleagues studying cuckoos, where, of course, you know, there's fantastic mimicry between the cuckoo's eggs and the host eggs. And taking DNA from the eggshell has allowed them to explore that in great detail.
And another story about the cuckoo I thought was interesting in reading your book, that they tend to lay their eggs in the afternoon. As opposed to
they do. Most small birds lay early in the morning, and they do that, it's thought, so that they don't have to carry that egg around inside their abdomen all day, which would make them more vulnerable to predators. They risk breaking the egg and so on. But the cuckoo typically lays in mid or late afternoon, and it does that precisely because the host species is going to lay in the morning and is therefore less likely to be in the vicinity of the nest that the cuckoo wants to parasitize. So by laying in the afternoon, it's more likely to go undetected than if it had to go in the morning and then had to battle with the host parents. And if the host see the cuckoo trying to lay, they're more likely to try and chuck out any strange egg. So it's laying in the afternoon is a good adaptation by the cuckoo female.
Gary and Glidden wondered why some countries refrigerate eggs and others don't.
Okay, that's a very interesting question as well. So there's been in the egg industry, there's been a lot of controversy about whether you should wash eggs and then whether you should keep them refrigerated or not. And I think the North America differs from Britain in this respect. And I think I'm right in saying that in Britain, they tend not to wash eggs, because there were some studies that showed that if you washed the eggs, any contamination, any microbes on there were more likely to be pushed down the pores by which the developing embryo breathes, and therefore cause some kind of contamination and poisoning. So in North America, I think they still wash eggs. In Britain, they don't wash eggs.
Well, we have just scratched the surface of the egg, so to speak, with you today, Tim. I tell you that there are some stories about Hewitt, the guy who collected over 500,000 eggs. And some other wonderful stories in there as well. It's been a delight talking with you today. I hope we get a chance to visit again. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Tim Burkhead teaches animal behavior at the University of Sheffield, fellow of the Royal Society of London, and award-winning author. He's a really great writer, and his book is called The Perfect Thing, Inside and Outside a Bird's Egg. Well, great to talk with him, and I know it's going to be fun to talk with our next author as well, because we're going to find out about what happened with the Daniel J. Morrell, the sinking of it, and one man's survival on the open sea. That next, here on the Ideas Network.